Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Anna Sale in for Brian Lehrer. Now we turn from economic news at your local small business to some startling economic news from the world's biggest economies. For decades, the World Bank and the IMF have helped steer economic development around the world. But now a coalition of emerging economies wants to rival those development groups and possibly shift the balance of power in the world's economy. Uri Dadush is director of the Carnegie Endowment's International Economics Program. He's also the author of Juggernaut, How Emerging Markets Are Reshaping Globalization. Uri Dadush, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
I'm glad to be with you. So let's begin with this story that the so-called BRICS nations, the emerging markets of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, are looking to establish a development bank of their own to bypass the World Bank and the IMF. Why do they want to do this?
Well, these, of course, are the big emerging economies accounting for a very large part of world economic growth now. And their desire to establish their own development bank, which goes back quite a while, is, I think, motivated by two things. One is fairly practical, which is that some of those countries would like to see more investment in infrastructure and feel that organizations like the World Bank are not paying enough attention to that particular aspect of development. But the more important motivation is geopolitical, which means that these countries are trying to assert themselves as players in the global economy that are differentiated from the traditional actors, the United States and the rest of the G7 advanced countries. And in so doing, they're trying to push a much broader agenda of increased weight and representation in international institutions and generally more influence on world affairs.
So you mentioned one difference is an interest in investing in infrastructure, but I want to also ask about sort of the values behind what this development bank might be about. The World Bank isn't just an economic institution. It's also its defining ethos is that free markets can promote democratic values. Is this development bank from the BRICS coalition, might it come from a different, slightly different angle?
Yes, I would say that they will come from a slightly different angle. The dominant player, of course, among the BRICS is China. I mean, in the same way, frankly, that the United States dominates the G7 or has dominated the G7 for a long time in terms of size and influence, China stands out as by far the biggest and most successful economy among the BRICS, and if you look at China's approach to foreign policy, it is very much one based on non-interference, based on allowing countries to pursue their own course. Whether we are talking about economic approaches or political setups, for obvious reasons, given the kind of regime that China has. So you might expect a BRICS development bank to be much less concerned with the broader context of politics and policies in which the economies that it invests in are engaged, and more focused on the specific projects. And the projects themselves may not carry quite as heavy a conditionality as, say, the World Bank or some of the other multilateral development banks that are dominated mainly by the advanced countries would want.
Less conditionality, so less of a conditions of saying this is what we expect to result as far as development and social development, economic development alongside.
Exactly. And, you know, many of these conditions, always implicit in these discussions, is what kind of regime do you have? Some countries are simply outside the pale for the developing for the development banks till today, the traditional development banks till today. So North Korea was for a long time, is for a long time. Iran is outside. Historically, many others have been. You might have less of those concerns, less perhaps insistence on environmental conditions and so on.
And in return, the BRICS countries would get better investment opportunities?
Well, again, in return, the BRICS countries are looking for influence. They're looking to focus this development bank much more on traditional infrastructure projects, which they feel are very important for them and for other developing countries, rather than perhaps a much broader array of development initiatives that the traditional development banks have been pushing.
How worried should U.S. companies and be about this? Are they going to lose out on investment opportunities if they're cut out of these development banking deals?
A little bit, I would say, but the amounts of money that they're talking about, first of all, are not that significant. They're talking about capital of $50 billion. This is peanuts, frankly, in today's world. Second, they haven't agreed any of the specifics. They've been talking about this for a long time. They haven't agreed any of the specifics, like where the bank will be located, how the amounts will be divided, and so on and so forth. Remember that as far as Western companies are concerned, the big action still and for the foreseeable future will be in the traditional development banks. That's where the big loans are today and are going to continue to be, even if they raise the full $50 billion, which is not assured. So the BRICS are, of course, members of these traditional development banks and borrow from them, and their companies base themselves on their projects and so on. So there's a lot of leverage that remains in the traditional system should the new development bank not play by the rules on procurement.
Do you anticipate that the plan is that if the new development bank raises the money it needs and is a success, will these BRICS nations stay members of the World Bank?
Definitely. I believe that will be the case. And they will, of course, stay members of the International Monetary Fund. They will remain members and are very active members of the G20, forum, because remember that since the fundamental objective is to raise their influence on global affairs, the center of these discussions will remain in the foreseeable future. I'm talking about a generation or two in the traditional fora of which all these countries are very active members. The WTO, throw that in as well.
So all of this, of course, is happening in the context of what's happening in the European economy. And every week, it seems like, the very existence of the EU gets threatened by one country or another. So how that is happening, and now there's this other potential development bank. How is this the best time to be creating these kind of opposite and new economic coalitions?
Well, again, I see this, frankly, as symbolic at this point. And you might say, well, it's another complication. But I would say it's an entirely minor and secondary one compared to the enormous challenges that, for example, Europe, since you mentioned Europe, I could also mention the challenges that the United States has. These challenges are predominantly domestic. This is about the Europeans getting their act together. It's about Republicans and Democrats getting their act together. In the United States, what is happening among those BRICS countries, their desire to establish a development bank and other joint initiatives are secondary. There is also, I think, a salutary effect, to be perfectly frank, of what the BRICS are doing, which is that it serves as a warning to the advanced economies, the traditional powers, that they need to pay more attention to these countries. They need to give them greater representation. They need to be more objective in the way that they approach development issues, in a way that doesn't just reflect or mainly reflect their own interests, the interests of the advanced countries, including geopolitical and security concerns, but also takes into account the broader community, where, after all, 90% of or 80% of the world population resides today.
So an incremental development in one way, but also a warning in terms of give us some attention. I want to ask you about another story that caught our eye this week. In 2011, the world spent $1.9 trillion in energy subsidies. And yesterday, the IMF said that that was not money well spent. They issued a statement that reads, subsidies cause overconsumption of petroleum products, coal, and natural gas, and reduce incentives for investment in energy efficiency and renewable energy. This overconsumption, in turn, aggravates global warming and worsens local pollution. So the IMF, making a clear statement on energy subsidies, as we were just saying, this new development bank moving away from conditionalities. But what do you make of this statement about energy subsidies and environmental policy from the IMF? How significant is it?
It is significant. By the way, it's not necessarily a counterpoint to what the BRICS are doing, because if you look at the what the BRICS concluded at their summit, one of the points that they make is that indeed energy subsidies are bad news, and that more should be done to reduce them. So there is, and this again reflects their activity as part of the G20, which was the originator of this focus on energy subsidies. But it is significant. It's significant in a number of ways. I think the study is an impressive piece of work, very comprehensive. It's significant because it comes from the International Monetary Fund, which carries a lot of weight, has a lot of analytical capacity, and it's significant because of the fairly detailed diagnosis that it puts forward, and the fact that it is based also on a lot of case studies of how countries have tried to reduce their energy subsidies, and provides a number of useful guidelines on how to do that successfully. Finally, last but not least, it's significant because it points to one country that is the largest energy subsidizer of the lot, and that is the United States of America, which, according to IMF calculations, spends about $500 billion on energy subsidies. Now, this might surprise some people, but the way that the calculation is done is it compares what prices should be of energy in the United States if energy was not just not subsidized in the form of payments to oil companies, et cetera, but also relative to where the price of energy should be if energy was taxed in the United States or gasoline was taxed along the lines of other products that are taxed in the country and in other countries, and also relative to where the price should be in order to reflect the polluting effects of traditional energy sources, including the effects on carbon emissions.
So any
if you include all those, then the United States is the biggest subsidizer of energy in the world.
And will this IMF statement do anything to change American policy on energy subsidies, do you expect?
I think it is the death of a thousand cuts. By that I mean that I don't think these energy subsidies are going to die quickly. But hopefully this is another cut. And maybe it's just number 200. And maybe we've got 800 other cuts to go. But one day, I think the cumulative evidence will confront United States politicians and oblige change.
All right. Uri Dedush is director of the Carnegie Endowment's International Economics Program. He's also the author of Juggernaut, How Emerging Markets Are Reshaping Globalization. Thanks so much for joining us on WNYC.
Thank you.